Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 9th, 2000.
A poet creates that sense of judgment. So, the first poem, I have them in some sort of order. It's by Margaret Atwood, who is a Canadian poet and novelist. Anyone in here familiar with Atwood's work? Okay, great.
The token Canadian.
The token Canadian, exactly. It's good to have a token Canadian. Every group benefits from that.
I'm at me.
Pardon me?
I'm at me.
Yes.
I knew that you were the token Canadian.
I didn't even ask for when you're...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. I think I have a total of 12 copies here, which means that each of you should receive, since there's one over there, 5/6 of a poem. And that may mean that there's a certain amount of sharing that goes on. So if you're sitting next to someone, particularly if it's someone you like, it might be nice to share. Margaret Atwood, I should say, is a contemporary of ours. She is still actively writing. So this is a very contemporary poem. And I don't have a title for it, so... And it also contains one typo, which you will probably find when I read it. Is everybody okay? See, we really do have bounty here. It's just... Okay. Let others pray for the passenger pigeon, the dodo, the whooping crane, the Eskimo. Everyone must specialize. I will confine myself to a meditation upon the giant tortoises, withering finally on a remote island. I concentrate in subway stations, in parks. I can't quite see them. They move in the peripheries of my eyes, but on the last day they will be there. Already the event, like a wave traveling, shapes vision. On the road where I stand, they will materialize, plodding past me in a straggling line, awkward without water, their small heads pondering from side to side, their useless armor sadder than thanks and history. In their closed gaze, ocean and sunlight paralyzed, lumbering up the steps, under the archways, toward the square glass altars where the brittle gods are kept, the relics of what we have destroyed, our holy and obsolete symbols. So take a minute and read it through again to yourself, because poetry doesn't get itself across on the first time. So what images seem to you most powerful in this poem? Or what lines?
I just found it interesting that she included people with the birds.
Yes, isn't that interesting? At the very beginning, those four, the passenger pigeon, which we know is extinct, and it used to fly across the Midwest in flocks so thick that they darkened the sky. And people shot vast numbers of them. And now they're gone. And the dodo, which we also know is extinct, but the whooping crane is not extinct. And the Eskimo is not extinct, at least not quite. So there's almost a sense that the poem is poised between extinction and the threat of extinction, and that it includes the human as well as the other species. If you can get to where you're next to somebody else, you can look on with the poem, and otherwise you'll have a hard time. Good. What else do people notice about the poem? Or images that you found?
I don't understand the one where it says sadder than things.
Yes, isn't that wonderful? Right.
What does that mean? I don't quite understand.
Well, that's what we have to unpack. That's what we have to decide, okay? So the tortoises are moving along. Can you get a picture there of the tortoises? Their sad heads pondering from side to side, their useless armor. So what's specifically sad is the armor. Okay, so the first thing you have to do is get the grammar of the poem straight. So we get that the armor is sadder than history, okay? So let's start with the history. What kind of sense does it make to say that the tortoises are sadder than history, or that their armor is sadder than history?
Oh, history repeats itself, maybe?
Okay, history repeats itself.
History is a litany of all the wrongs that have been done.
Okay, history is a litany of wrongs and injustices. All of the wrongs and injustices, or do you see this as being the wrongs and injustices to the tortoises?
I mean, just in the context of the poem, you would think against them, but I tend to think it's also, maybe it's both and.
Mm-hmm. I think it probably is a both and proposition, right, that it expands out. Sadder than history, other...
I mean, armor and war, more than history.
That's very nice, yes. So we've got armor that is sadder than history. So we think of arms and war. And here they are, in a sense, carrying their, it's not the breastplates, it's their backplates, but it's serving the same function to the final end. Yeah.
Well, I see it as being sad that the armor doesn't protect him from what's the problem now.
Okay.
But it doesn't anymore.
So they are sad at the lack of protection. And in that respect, you could say that their armor is pretty sorry. Yes.
Also, the comparative sadder than history, I mean, one can say for human history, history is usually written by the winners, and they're not winning. And even natural history of kind of Darwinism, if you think of survival of the fittest, well, then natural history would also be the ones who are surviving, and the threat of extinction means that they are going out of history. So if they don't even make it into history anymore, and that's what's sad.
Okay, so they are, in a sense, history's losers. They neither write the history, nor do they get to participate in it anymore. Now, one of the things to remember about tortoises, precisely on this subject, is what an ancient species they are. They've been around for, I think it's around something like 185, 190 million years. And not only are they ancient in that respect, but they are among the longest lived creatures on the planet. They live well over a century if they're allowed to live. So to be sadder than history, they carry that history. And they carry that history both in their sort of individual selves and in their genetic selves. Okay, that's great. I'm sure we could go on, but sadder than history. But what about sadder than thanks?
Maybe we just don't appreciate them. And that's what they're saying. Over the years, we've allowed them to die off. And we're not thankful for them. We don't care, in other words.
Yeah, that's nice, that humans are not thankful. And that's why the turtles are dying, in some sense. Yeah, other responses to sadder than thanks.
There's a sense that thanks isn't enough. Thanks is kind of superficial.
Yeah,
makes it all okay if we just say thanks.
Yeah, that there's something totally inadequate about anything that humans could say at this point to the turtle. That whatever we could say, beggars.
Made some nice purses and combs on.
Yeah, nice burrettes. Right, right. Good soup. Right, right. Nice. Other images in the poem that you found were interesting or puzzling?
Oh, the last line, the brittle gods, or they're kept in these glass cages.
Mm-hmm.
She calls it an altar.
Mm-hmm. 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 Okay, let's go there, because that's an important place in the poem. In lots of cases, poems are sort of like jokes. They have punchlines, you know, that like the end of the poem makes a judgment or makes a comment on whatever it is that the poet has been writing about. So what do you make of the square glass altars?
Museum.
I think a museum.
Yeah, it's a window. It's the glass case.
Or, you know, a museum of natural histories where they have either a tortoise or a replica of a real tortoise and say, this is how they work.
Yeah, right, right. Good. Anything else that you associate with the square glass altars?
I think television,
sure, right. This is how people see them now. There's no contact. Okay, good, what else?
Not the giant tortoise, but as kids get little turtles and put them in little aquariums, trap them.
Mm-hmm. That's not how you spell aquarium, is it? Okay, good. So then those become sort of the child's participation in the life. Anything else, square group? Yes.
I remember an experiment we had in high school, which is despicable, but we had to see how long it took a turtle to die by starving it to death.
Wow.
I think I can vaguely recall that in high school. I mean, we're talking 50 years ago.
Okay. But I think that what you bring up is really important, that in some senses, the turtles and many, many other species have died in the name of, not the whole species, but individuals of them, have died in the name of science and in the name of education. Even today, you know, even in high schools, I think they're still dissecting animals when there are lots of computer programs that would probably give the vast majority of students. I mean, I can see if you're going to be a vet that it would be a good idea to dissect, but anyway. Any other associations with the square glass altar? See, this is what's so much fun, is when you get lots of different ones, it really enriches the poem. Yes.
A zoo, maybe?
Zoos?
That's
sure.
The only place where the species might be left.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in zoos, you'd probably see them in some kind of glass containers. Any others?
Maybe it's even the counter in a store where you buy the tortoise shell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good one. But you see so many people going around with nature t-shirts on. They buy the rainforest t-shirt, they've got the little rainforest frog or something like that. And it's a kind of fetishism almost that takes the image of the animal and it expiates it. It makes the person feel, oh, I'm for nature. See, I wear these nature t-shirts. And, you know, to some extent there's that in the souvenir hunting, but also just in the commercializing, the commercial use of the animal. Why do you think she calls them altars? Okay, that's nice. There's a kind of sacrificial, so that it underlines the sacrifice element of it. I like that. Anything else? The responses to altars, yes.
She also calls them brittle gods, like they are false gods or altars to false gods, the man-made ones.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a kind of there's certainly a heavy irony in calling them altars, isn't there? That they're sacrificing their brittle gods And brittle is a wonderful word there because you can imagine the turtle's shells becoming brittle after the life of the animal is gone, but also that whatever it is that is being served in this process is a false god, is a brittle god. Any other responses to altars there?
Well, the fact that an altar is considered to be a holy place, and by sacrificing it in this holy place, it somehow makes the sacrifice somehow more worthy.
That's very interesting.
In our justification of it.
Or
we sacrifice it to the holy god of science,
mm-hmm.
so we may bemoan its passing, but see what we've done, see how we elevated it.
So it sort of suggests the elevation of our interests to a godlike status. You know, you sacrifice it to science. So you look at, what are all these altars? Well, aren't there people who virtually worship TV? You know, you think about it. Probably not so many people worship aquariums. But there are people who worship science. For sure, and who feel that science is the end of it all. So there's a sense of the objects of false worship. Great. The relics of what we have destroyed. And again, she's using specifically religious language here in order to indicate what's wrong with this picture. What's wrong with the loss of these species? To call these holy relics is, I mean, I thought where you were going, which would have been another interesting tack to take, is that the religious language of the last stanza both mocks the elevation of false gods and actually ennobles the sacrifice of the tortoises, because she says that these are our holy and obsolete symbols. Well, you know, you can take that both ways. You can take it as critical of those people who worship at these false altars, but you can also take it as, yes, there is something holy about these tortoises, something holy that's lost from creation. When their life is gone, when they're gone as a species. So that it, you know, it does both of those things at the same time. Literary critics like that. They like that sense that there's a double meaning there, that contradictories are included. Notice the way she does the physical imagining of the tortoises. It's really quite good. First, she locates herself in the city, and she doesn't have to say anything more than subway stations, and she's got herself located in the city because that's the only place where there are subway stations. So here she is, she's this city person, and she's decided to meditate on the loss of a species thousands of miles away. I went and looked up in the World Book Encyclopedia something on tortoises. The giant tortoises live on the Galapagos Islands. And other islands. They are land creatures. They're not sea animals. Tortoise means land turtle. Turtle implies both. So she locates herself in the city and knows that the focus is wrong, that she can't quite see them, but that they exist somehow in the periphery of her vision. Which is true in the city. Any of you live in cities?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How much wildlife do you find in the city? Pigeons? Squirrels?
Squirrels.
Raccoons and possums.
Some raccoons and possums, yeah. There's a man lives down the street from me, traps squirrels. I completely don't understand it unless he's eating them. It's be like, I mean, it's like trapping flies. There's so many of them. But I'm always grateful for the presence of the squirrels in the city. You know, I know they're rodents, but there's a little bit of wildness there. But if you live in a city, to keep in mind what's going on the rest of the planet requires a meditation. And I think that's why she says, in a sort of ironic and self-deprecatory way, everyone must specialize. I will confine myself to a meditation on the choices. But there is a sense that this requires a tremendous mindfulness if you're not confronted with it every day. I mean, I could see that if you lived out here, it would be a whole different experience to think about the natural world. And then she conjures this vision. I wonder what you how you respond to the line. It's in the fourth stanza, but on the last day they will be there. Already the event, like a wave traveling, shapes vision. What do you think she means by the last day, or how do you respond to that?
Well, I was thinking of two things. One was like the last day she's in the city, she's visiting. But more is like the last day the turtles were alive, or when they've all gone at this point.
Mm-hmm. That once they've lost their lives, then we get these sort of spectral turtles that come in. That's very nice. Anybody have any other associations with the last day?
Judgment Day.
Yeah, I mean, I think given the religious imagery in the poem, I think that it, at least in part, suggests that we're looking at a judgment day. Any others? And what about this notion that already the event, like a wave traveling, shapes vision? Can you picture that? It's a little hard to picture, I think. I mean, there's a sense that something, some tremendous event takes place in the future that causes a wave almost in the time field, and that that wave, as it approaches us, shapes the way we see. And then she goes into her vision. And look at the verb she uses, plodding in a straggling line, pondering, lumbering. Aren't they wonderful words to get a sense of the bulk of the turtles and their slow movement? Their slow movement, out of place in the city, awkward, up, lumbering up the steps, under the archways, and you can almost picture some sort of gigantic natural history museum to sacrifice themselves at these altars. So one of the questions that this poem leaves me with, which I want to just sort of throw out, and we'll consider it with the others as well, is what is it that city people lose when we lose a species? When we lose a species that we never see, what is it that we lose, we humans? And I'll let you think about that. And you can, if you have thoughts about it, please feel free to share them, but yes.
In our native way, I think that we're losing part of our spirit.
Losing part of our spirit.
In our native, Native American way.
Do you want to talk about that for a sec?
As Native American people, it ends up, the honoring of the earth is, one of our highest priorities before, along with being part of our native spirituality. One of the things of honoring our earth is respecting the earth. So it ends up, the earth is our giver of life, and it ends up what we get from the earth, both from the trees, from the animals, from the plants, are from the berries. In our native background is that we give thanks to the earth before we take what we're going to gather, what we're going to harvest, or what we're going to capture. And it ends up, when we honor what we're taking, then we are honoring the earth by saying that we thank you for letting us have what we're taking. And then if we do that, then we are giving respect back to the earth. If we lose a species, especially a species of many of us that are of the salmon people of the Northwest, if we lose a species of salmon, we are losing the spirit of the earth that has been the giver of life for us in the Northwest.
So to lose one of the creatures of the earth is also to lose
part of
ourselves. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Pardon?
That was very beautiful.
It was
said.
Beautifully
thank
spoken.
You.
Thank you. Yeah. And I know the Plains people have a greeting that they use in ceremonial situations, in which they say "Metaquiasin," and "Metaquiasin" means greetings to all my relations. And their belief is that not only the animals, but the water, the rocks, and the sky are relations. So that to ask, what do we lose when we lose a species, is like asking, what do we lose when we lose a member of our family? And that's hard to put in words. But we lose something unique. We lose something precious. Okay, I don't want to give short shrift to these other poems. So here comes the second one, which is not really about threatened and endangered species, but is about animal deaths, so I figured I'd sneak it in. And again, if you can do some sharing of poems, that will help. I think each person now gets something like... okay, but I gave you more than you need, so thanks. Has everybody got a poem they can at least look on with? Okay, great. James Dickey is a Southern poet. You probably know him from the movie Deliverance, which was his novel. He is also a contemporary. So here goes this one. Here they are, the soft eyes open. If they have lived in a wood, it is a wood. If they have lived on plains, it is grass rolling under their feet forever. Having no souls, they have come anyway beyond their knowing. Their instincts wholly bloom and they rise, the soft eyes open. To match them, the landscape flowers, outdoing desperately, outdoing what is required, the richest wood, the deepest field. For some of these, it could not be the place it is without blood. These hunt as they have done, but with claws and teeth grown perfect. More deadly than they can believe, they stalk more silently and crouch on the limbs of trees, and their descent upon the bright backs of their prey may take years in a sovereign floating of joy. And those that are hunted know this as their life, their reward. To walk under such trees in full knowledge of what is in glory above them, and to feel no fear, but acceptance, compliance, fulfilling themselves without pain. At the cycle's center, they tremble. They walk under the tree, they fall, they are torn, they rise, they walk again. So take a minute to read it through again on your own. Okay, what images or lines in this poem seem interesting or striking to you?
I think the difference between the first couple verses where it's kind of, I'm thinking of a deer at first.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about soft eyes, it's gentle,
mm-hmm.
and then it swishes to this blood and hunt and claws, teeth.
Nature red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson put it. Yeah, it is in contrast, isn't it? What do you think when you read it at the very beginning? Here they are. Who's they and where are they?
Well,
it helps open up the mind to stand there, give you an image of something that you don't know.
Right. At first, you don't know what he's talking about, so it sort of invites you to imagine.
Make your own imagination.
Make your own imagination. But as it develops, what's the here? What would you describe the here?
A woods or somewhere.
A woods somewhere? Or a field? Okay. What else could you say about it? What's happened to the animals?
They've gotten to have smaller and smaller spaces where they can live.
I think maybe I'm asking the questions wrong.
Yeah, but I think what it is if they are, I don't know, could be in a zoo, could be maybe in as I reread this, it's like they're in some place out of their natural place. They're not in the fields. They're not in the wood, but here they're here.
Okay.
And their soft eyes open. Sounds like they've lost their kind of strength, or there's something that is weak about them. Or so either they've been hunted, or they are being cared for, maybe in a veterinary place, or they're in a zoo or something. Mm-hmm. That's what I begin to read.
Well, it's interesting. I'm the only one that read it this way, but I read this as animal heaven, or the animal afterlife, or something like that. Here they are, and then what goes on is everything has been made perfect. Everything has been rendered in its purest form for them. Look at it that way and see if it makes any sense. If they have lived in a wood, it is a wood. If they have lived on plains, it is grass rolling under their feet forever. So whatever animal heaven is, it's different for each animal, but it's perfect. Mm-hmm. It's the perfect habitat for each animal. And then we have the line, having no souls, they have come anyway, beyond their knowing. This isn't heaven as we think about it, but it's whatever heaven is for animals. They have come anyway beyond their knowing. And to me, that the suggestion is that human beings are distinguished from animals by knowing, by the foreknowledge of death, and by consciousness, which there are people who would argue that animals are perfectly conscious, they just don't have a language that we can understand. But I mean, I think that we have a sense that there are differences between us and the other animals. But what happens here is that their instincts wholly bloom. And once again, we're working with puns and allusions and references, because the word wholly obviously is written one way, but sounds another way. And so we have a kind of sanctity about this place. Their instincts wholly bloom. Now, we would not say that when a human soul goes to heaven, her instincts are what distinguish her life in heaven. But for the animals, that being their distinguishing characteristics, their instincts wholly bloom, and they rise. The soft eyes open. Soft eyes. He repeats that twice. It does sound like a deer, doesn't it? We think of deer as having soft eyes. I don't know. Anybody have any thoughts about animals and their eyes? And what's soft about them?
Deer have, I think, have a very soft look. It's always a cow.
So do cows. You know, it would be really interesting to know, and this is something that I completely don't know, we assume that predatory animals have very sharp senses, right? That the cat has sharp senses, the predators have very sharp senses of smell and hearing and vision. I have been told, and this boggles the mind, that an owl can hear a mouse's heartbeat at 100 yards. How do they find them otherwise? I mean, there they are down in the grasses. You know, and the predator just knows where the prey is. So perhaps the softness is suggestive of the prey creatures rather than the predator creatures, which we're going to get both of here. Mm-hmm. To match them in this animal afterlife, the landscape flowers, and notice how he uses flowers and bloom there in parallel ways, so that in one stanza we've got their instincts bloom and then the landscape flowers. There's this sense of abundance that he's creating for this afterlife. But the next line is so interesting because he says, outdoing, desperately outdoing what is required. And if it had simply said outdoing what is required, that would sort of be, gosh, this is even better than we ever expected, but the desperately. Anybody have any responses to the word desperately in there?
The life force of the plant goes into the bloom, and then the seed.
And then is eaten, did you say?
No. Into the seed, then it dies.
And into seed, right. Does anybody know what the root of the word desperate is? It's for despair, and it means without hope. Which just seems like an interesting word in here. As though the landscape were trying to make up to the animals for their deaths, for their loss, but without hope of ever fully being able to compensate them. So we get, again, this sort of intensification, the instincts wholly bloom, the landscape flowers, the richest wood, the deepest field. And then we move into what's going to be the meat of the poem, and that is the predator-prey relationship. And for predators, you know, we have, as humans, ethics that tell us that we must not kill, that we must not harm others. Of course we do. I mean, we eat meat. We sacrifice other beings in order to feed ourselves and so on. But that we don't kill our own kind, certainly. Well, we do. But you know what I'm saying. But for the animal, the predation is utterly, utterly right. It's appropriate. It's what the animal does. The cougar has to prey. The tiger must prey. The panther must prey. The eagle must prey. It's the way they are. Of course, here I'm using a pun myself, but these hunt as they have done, but with claws and teeth grown perfect. So again, this distillation, this perfection in the place, is a perfection of predation as well. And they are more deadly than they can believe. I mean, we all have skills, and we practice our skills, and most of the time we're okay at them, but sometimes we goof up, right? I mean, the carpenter hits his thumb with the hammer sometimes, and everybody makes mistakes, but here the animals even are making mistakes, and their predation is not perfect. So in the afterlife, their predation is more deadly. They stalk more silently and crouch on the limbs of trees, and their descent upon the bright backs of their prey may take years in a sovereign floating of joy. I love that image. I mean, if you picture the cat up on the tree branch, and the prey is going by, and the cat is forever floating in the air on the way down, knowing that this is going to be this perfect act, this perfect kill. Well, that's great. That's great for the cat. But what about the roe that's walking by when the cat descends from the tree? What about the victim? How can heaven be made perfect for the victim? That's the problem that the poet sets himself up for. And he answers that this is this as their life, their reward is to walk under such trees in full knowledge of what is in glory above them, and to feel no fear, but acceptance, compliance, fulfilling themselves without pain. So there at the end of the poem, there's this sense that for the prey, the fullest expression of their being is to be someone else's kill, to be someone else's food, to be someone else's nourishment. It's done without pain. It seems to be done with a little bit of fear. At the cycle center, they tremble, they walk under the tree, they fall, they are torn, they rise, they walk again. Anybody have any associations in those last couple of stanzas? Yes.
It sort of tells like about the circle of life, that life actually comes around to, it's almost its beginning. In another one of our native traditions, is the medicine we are teaching.
Yes, it hasn't.
We go through our cycle of life and we come back to actually where we have come from. Mm-hmm. And it's Takashala in the middle, who mm-hmm. is our mediator and our creator. Mm-hmm. And part of this poem that I was seeing in that flow was at the end that they come back to Takashala mm-hmm. at the end.
Mm-hmm. That's very nice, yeah. Mm-hmm. That sense of the cycle of the medicine circle.
Of life.
Right.
Anyone else have associations with this last couple of stanzas? Yes?
The resurrection. The reference to a tree falling.
Right, a tree in full knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Rising and walking again.
Mm-hmm.
And even before that, trembling, a little bit of fear, being a little bit afraid to drink of the cup, but knowing that you must.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very good.
Mm-hmm. What about what was your?
Well, I was saying, you know, the cross. Christ was hung on a tree.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm. right.
And then mm-hmm. that kind of, he was torn.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
right.
And he rose and
that's
walked
right.
again.
In full knowledge of what was in glory above him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And to feel no fear but acceptance, mm-hmm. compliance, fulfilling themselves without pain. It's a very interesting meditation on the predator-prey relationship in a religious context. And tomorrow night, just to tease you, I have a poem in which the poet imagines himself as a predator with God as the prey. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little coming attractions.